Hello everyone, I'm Nick and we're going to be considering Genesis 42 together. We're going to read it in a little while. If you don't have a Bible, just chuck your hand up and maybe Emily can pass some around. Thanks Emily, a couple, one up the back and one over here. So open up to Genesis 42 if you do have a Bible or if one's coming to you. Let me start with this quote that you see it on the screen. A clear conscience is the sure sign of a bad memory. A clear conscience is the sure sign of bad memory or memory loss. Our consciences are pretty incredible. We remember back many years to all sorts of events, particularly when they're tied to some emotion, when they've brought us some kind of emotional reaction. Maybe brought us to tears or brought us to joy. I don't remember a lot of my childhood. In fact, my wife sometimes suggests that maybe I was whacked over the head as about a 10-year-old because of how little I remember before that point. But I do remember a few events that are particularly significant. One was when I was swimming and nearly drowned and came up kind of full of water, coughed it all up. And I can still hear, as I kind of recount that memory now, my swimming teacher and her words to me yelling, "Breathe, breathe, come up, kick, kick, kick." And I'm kind of exploding with water. I remember that. I remember my grandfather's birthday. Maybe, I think it was his 75th birthday. I think I was about 6 or 7 years old. And he had a fall and whacked his head on the corner of a table. And he was pretty badly injured, ended up in hospital. And I remember everything about that scene, exactly the room layout, where people were standing, the corner of the table, is just stuck in my memory. And I also remember this event at church where a mate of mine shoved me into a bush, a tree. And I remember it with similar clarity to the clarity with which I remember those other events. And yet, it's kind of a bit of an innocuous one. There's nothing really to it. Why was that? Because at school, around the same time, I was getting bullied a bit and pushed around into things like trees and buildings and such things. And that now transferred to my safe zone, to church. A mate had pushed me into a tree there. And so the emotion that went with one went with the other. And the revenge I felt towards one group of people was now transferring to another, to a close mate. How do we deal with that kind of revenge? It might be an event that's stuck in your conscience from many years ago that you can kind of hold on to, and you hear from someone or you think of that event and you hold on to the revenge. Maybe it's a betrayal you've suffered at some point. And that's bringing up these kind of feelings of these desires for revenge that well up inside you. How do we respond when feelings like that, whether they're significant or even just a little more minor, how do we respond when they kind of well up inside us and we want to get back at someone? There's a bunch of options. Have a look on the screen. You'll see a few. Top left, public shaming. Public shaming. Bottom left, get back, do exactly to them what they've done to you. Lock the police car's wheels. On the right, a little more complex and sophisticated an endeavour. Hide their important assignment behind a whole bunch of folders and then subfolders, and use those folders to write down what's happened and how you feel towards them. Various options. I imagine this was done in the day before searches were really powerful, so you could just, you know, command space on a Mac and find the item. But anyway, it's an option. How do you respond? What kind of revenge options might you be tempted to take? Now, others might be that you could plan for the other person, plan for them to feel pain in some way. You could give them the cold shoulder. You could not respond to them. After a period of time, you could let them kind of suffer it out, wondering how you're feeling towards them. You could bring the incident up every time you see them in some sly or subtle way so they remember what they've done to you for years down the track. Or you could resist offers of reconciliation. They want forgiveness from you, they ask for it, and you just leave it. You resist. What do we do? What do we do when we feel that revenge? I'm just going to black slide. How do we resist taking revenge? Well, we're looking at the story of Joseph in Genesis, and I'll give you a bit of background and then we'll read this next section in chapter 42 together. The background is that Joseph's had these two dreams, these dreams of his brothers and then his mum and dad bowing down to him, kind of honouring, worshipping him while he's in this position of authority. And he tells this dream, both these dreams, to his family, to his brothers, to his dad, and you can imagine their response to them. Joseph ends up as a sold as a slave into Egypt. He first tries to get killed, but then ends up as a slave in Egypt. And he becomes this servant of a rich official, but then wrongfully gets chucked into prison, and he gets put in charge again. And in prison, he meets some important Egyptian officials who have access to the Pharaoh. And Joseph interprets the dreams in prison of these two officials, and so later on, he's called to interpret the dreams of the Pharaoh, because one of them ends up back in the service of the Pharaoh. And by interpreting the Pharaoh's dreams, the dream is about 7 years of famine for Egypt, and then seven years of prosperity for Egypt, and then 7 years of famine. And Joseph adds to his interpretation of the dream and gives advice to the Pharaoh. He says, put a wise man in charge of the land to store up grain during the time of prosperity so that they have grain during the time of famine. And guess who's the wise man? It's Joseph. He gets chosen as the wise man. He's put in charge of all of Egypt. He's effectively second in command of the world in terms of his power. And he does what he advised. He stores up during the prosperity, and he begins to give out during the famine. But it's not just the Egyptians he's giving out to. This famine has spread across pretty much all the known world, which is where we pick up the story in chapter 42. And so we'll read that together. I think Daniel's reading it for us. We'll read up to verse 20 of chapter 42.
Hi, I'm Daniel, and when Jacob learned that there was grain for sale in Egypt, he said to his sons, "Why do you look at one another?" And he said, "Behold, I have heard that there is grain for sale in Egypt. Go down and buy grain for us there, that we may live and not die." So 10 of Joseph's brothers went down to buy grain in Egypt. But Jacob did not send Benjamin, Joseph's brother, with his brothers, for he feared that harm might happen to him. Thus the sons of Israel came to buy among the others who came, for the famine was in the land of Canaan. Now Joseph was governor over the land. He was the one who sold to all the people of the land. And Joseph's brothers came and bowed themselves before him with their faces to the ground. Joseph saw his brothers and recognized them, but he treated them like strangers and spoke roughly to them. "Where do you come from?" he said. They said, "From the land of Canaan to buy food." And Joseph recognized his brothers, but they did not recognize him. And Joseph remembered the dreams that he had dreamed of them. And he said to them, "You are spies. You have come to see the nakedness of the land." They said to him, "No, my lord. Your servants have come to buy food. We are all sons of one man. We are honest men. Your servants have never been spies." He said to them, "No, it is the nakedness of the land that you have come to see." And they said, "We, your servants, are 12 brothers, the sons of one man in the land of Canaan. And behold, the youngest is this day with our father, and one is no more." But Joseph said to them, "It is as I said to you, you are spies. By this you shall be tested. By the life of Pharaoh, you shall not go from this place unless your youngest brother comes here. Send one of you and let him bring your brother while you remain confined, that your words may be tested, whether there is truth in you. Or else, by the life of Pharaoh, surely you are spies." And he put them all together in custody for 3 days. On the third day, Joseph said to them, "Do this and you will live, for I fear God. If you are honest men, let one of your brothers remain confined where you are in custody, and let the rest go and carry grain for the famine of your households, and bring your youngest brother to me, so your words will be verified and you shall not die." And they did so.
Thanks. So we're about 1.5 the way through the story, 1.5 out of the 3 scenes. There's the first scene when they head from Canaan to Egypt, and then there's the time in Egypt, and that's where we kind of finish there. And then there's the return from Egypt to Canaan, and you'll see those as the outline on your outline there. So beginning in scene 1, from Canaan to Egypt, Jacob learns that there's grain in Egypt, And he says to his sons, why do you keep looking at each other? Verse 2, listen, he went on, I've heard that there's grain in Egypt. Go down there and buy some for us so that we will live and not die. So the famine is affecting Canaan, where Jacob's family is, and it's severe, so severe that they will die if they don't do something about it. Their survival's on the line. God's plan to build this nation, this great family nation in the land of Canaan, their prosperity is on the line. But the brothers, they're looking at one another. They're struggling with initiative. Maybe they're just like some young fellas still living at home, kind of looking around, waiting for dad to make the decisions for them. Maybe actually there's something more going on here. They're divided amongst themselves. They can't work out who should make the decision. They're dysfunctional together. They're worried about what their dad might think about their dad finding out about what they've done to their brother Joseph previously. And so they're doing nothing. They're idle. They're hungry. They're in famine. It seems that they have their own families too to provide for, and they're doing nothing about it. They're just looking at one another. I wonder if you've experienced something of this in your share houses, just looking at one another, waiting for the fridge to fill up by its own or someone to arrive with food. Hopefully it hasn't got this bad that it's famine. Jacob breaks the silence and he says, verse 2, that there's grain in Egypt, and he orders them to go, and they do. Verse 3, 10 of the brothers, so all of Joseph's half-brothers, all go to buy grain from Egypt. But verse 4, it's not the youngest who goes as well. So Benjamin, he's now about 30 years old. He's Joseph's full brother, and he stays with his dad, Jacob. Why? Because he's the favorite. He's taken the place of Joseph as the favorite. Jacob's worried that something might happen to him. And the brothers go this long journey to Egypt. We'll see how far it is. It's maybe 10 days' journey, maybe 400 kilometers, a little less than that. And when they get there, they find that there's people from all nations there. Have a look at verse 5. The sons of Israel, or Jacob, were among those who came to buy grain, for the famine was in the land of Canaan. They were among those who came to buy grain. So there's many who've come from around the known world to Egypt to buy grain. And verse 6, in Egypt, they meet Joseph. Joseph was in charge of the country. He sold grain to all its people. His brothers came and bowed down before him with their faces to the ground. When Joseph saw his brothers, he recognized them. But they don't recognize him. See, Joseph is the chief grain seller in Egypt. Thousands of people have come to buy grain from him. And just think about the promise to Abraham. A descendant of Abraham, someone from his family, providing for the nations. Blessing to the nations. An overflow of God's promise to Abraham, but Joseph's alone. He's the only one there. It's not all of Israel being a blessing to the nations, it's just one guy. And what he's providing is not an overflow of Israel's prosperity, it's of Egypt's abundance that he's providing to them. So the promise to Abraham's not yet fulfilled completely. But amidst these thousands who've come from the nations, Joseph sees these 10 guys come towards him. 10 men together, and he recognizes them, but they don't recognize him. You know, they're looking down, and so maybe they don't look up to see him. Or 20 or 22 years have probably passed by this point, and so maybe he's changed enough that they don't recognize him. He's wearing Egyptian clothing. He's now shaven rather than unshaven. Maybe they've assumed that he would have died by now anyway. You know, 20 years, slavery, he would have died doing that. Joseph's in this great position of power over his brothers here. He knows it's them. He knows all the evil they've done to him previously, and they're right there bowing down before him. What will he do? He knows they need food. But he doesn't know about Benjamin and his dad Jacob. Are they still alive? Have the brothers done to Benjamin what they did to Joseph? Is he no more? What will Joseph do? Verse 7, he treated them like strangers and spoke harshly to them, severely, hard words. Where do you come from? He asked. From the land of Canaan to buy food, they replied. Although Joseph recognized his brothers, they didn't recognize him. Joseph remembered his dreams about them and said to them, "You are spies. You've come to see the weakness of the land." So why these harsh words to his brothers? Is he putting on a show so that his fellow Egyptians won't recognize what he's doing? His ultimate goals, maybe providing for them a little more than everyone else is getting, or something like that. Notice in verse 9, the narrator makes us this point of telling us that Joseph remembered his dreams and then calls them spies. Remember Joseph's dreams? 11 brothers, not 10, bowing down before him. And also his mum and dad bowing down. And so where are the other three? There's some people missing from the picture. Why have they not come to Egypt? Isn't that the fulfillment the dream's meant to have? It's those who's closest to him who have not come at this point. His dad, his full brother. And so Joseph sets out to find out about them. But look how he does it. Verse 10. Joseph, he calls them spies. He continues to accuse them of espionage. And they continue to protest their innocence. But he presses them over and over, and increasingly they reveal more information. Verse 11. "We're all sons of one man. We're honest. Your servants are not spies." Well, verse 13, they replied, we your servants, were 12 brothers, the sons of one man in the land of Canaan. The youngest is now with our father, and one is no longer living." Joseph's just found out some information. And you'd think he'd be overjoyed, right? He's just found out that his brother and his dad are still alive. But aren't these also really hard words for him to hear? Imagine being Joseph at this point with all that's been done to you. He too is a son of this one man. He is the brother who's no longer living, according to their thoughts. Imagine the temptation at this point to say, "It's me, I'm alive, hello." Or to take revenge on them, given all they've done to him. What does he do? Verse 15, he doesn't take revenge. He resists that temptation. Instead, he tests them. Verse 15, "This is how you'll be tested. As surely as Pharaoh lives, you will not leave this place unless your youngest brother comes here. Send one from among you to get your brother. The rest of you will be imprisoned so that your words can be tested to see if they're true. If they're not, as surely as Pharaoh lives, you are spies." So Joseph imprisoned them together for 3 days. Notice he imprisons them together. Together. The brother who's meant to have gone back is still with them. And so it seems here Joseph is giving them a taste of what they gave him. Remember the pit? Remember the prison that he ended up in because of their actions? Just a bit of a taste for them. He's remembered. And now he's giving them a chance to remember as well. But will they remember? From verse 18, he then changes his plan. 3 days have passed. Joseph says to them, "I fear God. Do this and you will live. If you are honest, let only one of you be confined to the guardhouse or the prison, while the rest of you go and take grain to relieve the hunger of your households. Bring your youngest brother to me so that your words can be confirmed. Then you won't die." And they consented to this. See, only detaining one brother means a whole lot more grain can be carried back to his family. But this apparent compassion is a great risk for Joseph. You know, will they come back with Benjamin when only one of them is detained, only Simeon? You know, previously they've been happy to get rid of one, Joseph, to leave him. And so he's testing them. Are they as heartless now as they were all those years before? Notice Joseph's heart here, verse 18, is motivated by his fear of God. See, to his brothers, just think about those words, "I fear God." To his brothers, this is an Egyptian professing to fear God. Will they fear God? Will this remind them, prick their conscience, their fear of God? Will that be awakened through this? Well, verse 21, we see they said to each other, "Obviously we're being punished for what we did to our brother. We saw his deep distress when he pleaded with us, but we would not listen. That is why this trouble has come to us." But Reuben replied, "Didn't I tell you not to harm the boy?" But you wouldn't listen. Now we must account, or give an account, for his blood. See, Reuben, like their father Jacob, it seems, thinks Joseph is dead. They haven't told him the full story, it seems. It's harshness. That's how hard-hearted they've been. But here, verse 22, they recognize their guilt. They confess their complicity, at least to one another. In pleading for their lives, they remember hearing Joseph doing exactly that, pleading for his life from the pit as they sat around eating dinner together. In verse 23, they recount how Joseph felt, his distress. And as they do that, he hears and understands every word that they're saying to one another. He relives the moment of their hatred towards him. But what does that inspire in him? Does it well up retribution, revenge? Well, no, he weeps. He weeps. They've admitted their guilt, and it seems that deep down he loves them. Reconciliation is now a possibility. Which I think is what we see in what happens next. Have a look at verse 24, halfway through. He turns back. He has Simeon imprisoned, bound, as they'd agreed to. And then he sends them back to Canaan, loaded with grain. And notice how loaded they are. He gave them orders to fill their containers, returns their money to their sacks, gives them provisions for the journey, and then they load their grain on the donkeys as they go. It's this picture of abundance. All this stuff has been given back to them. Like they've got the grain for free. Their money's even gone back. I wonder what the Egyptian servants would be thinking as this is happening. This isn't what we gave the last customer. This is kind of a special service. Who are these people? Joseph is surely taking a risk for his brothers here. A great risk. But why return the money? Why return the silver coins? Well, keep that in mind. We'll come back to it. We get to the next scene, the third scene, from Egypt to Canaan. Verse 27, the place where they lodged for the night, one of them opened his sack to get feed for his donkey, and he saw the money there at the top of his bag. He said to his brothers, "My money's been returned, it's here in my bag," and their hearts sank. Trembling, they turned to one another and said, "What is this that God has done to us?" When they reached their father Jacob in the land of Canaan, they told him all that had happened to them. And look down in verse 35, the same feeling seemed to overcome them as they recount the story to their father, and then they find the money in their sacks, and they were afraid. So why is this silver in the sacks? Why does Joseph do that? Just chat to the person next to you for a sec, or find someone next to you, and answer that question. Why is this silver in the sacks? What's Joseph doing by this? Go for it. Grab a couple of responses. Why is the silver in the sacks?
It's a lot lighter than 10 bags of grain.
The silver's lighter than 10 bags of grain.
So it's a bit obvious if they give them another 10 bags of grain.
Right, okay.
Bag coins
so,
is...
right, it's a way to give them more by giving them less.
Yeah.
Right? Interesting. Others?
A way to ensure they go back or make them feel guilty.
How so?
If they feel like they're in danger, they haven't paid for what they've taken,
okay,
then it would make them feel like they need to
Yeah. We've stolen this stuff. Was that an accident? We better give it back, that kind of feeling.
Yeah, we live next door to the world's greatest power and we've just stolen
it. Maybe they're coming after us. Maybe they're following.
Yeah.
Yep. Others?
Social experiment.
Social experiment. With ethics approval?
When they come back, will they admit that they stole, like they appear to have stolen money?
Yeah.
Will they pretend that back? They know nothing about it?
Yeah.
Sold him for a bag of silver.
So they sold Joseph for a bag of silver.
Was it Needham?
Okay.
Wow.
Yes. Yeah. And maybe the silver's doing something there in that memory thing as they pull it out. Oh, that's what we did too. Okay. Various options there. You know, Joseph's generosity, wants to provide for his family, reminds them of the being sold by them, testing if they'll come back. Making sure they will come back for Simeon. Maybe it's kind of another incentive to come back, to give it back, so they don't get found out another way. I wonder if it's a bit of a combination of those things. He's testing their honesty with his generosity. He's testing their honesty with his generosity. Have a look at Jacob's reaction, verse 36. Their father Jacob said to them, "You've deprived me of my sons. Joseph is gone and Simeon is gone. Now you want to take Benjamin. Everything happens to me." You've heard the child say that, isn't it? Yeah, the world's against me. It's so bad. Everybody hates me. Everyone in the whole world. It's that kind of picture. Yeah. He's distraught. He blames them. It probably looks to him like they've sold Simeon for a tidy profit. And of course, he won't let Benjamin suffer the same fate. He's lost Joseph and Simeon and now Benjamin? No way. He's not going. Verse 30, they retell the account of what happened in Egypt to their dad Jacob, but they're selective with the details. Have a look at these words on the screen. I'll read them and just think of what's missing here. The man who is the lord of the country spoke harshly to us and accused us of spying on the country, but we told him we're honest and not spies. We were 12 brothers, sons of the same father. One is no longer living. The youngest is now with our father in the land of Canaan. The man who is the lord of the country said to us, "This is how I will know if you are honest. Leave one brother with me. Take food to relieve the hunger of your households and go. Bring back your youngest brother to me, and I will know that you are not spies, but honest men. I will then give your brother back to you, and you can trade in the country." Just quickly, anyone notice anything missing?
Last sentence of that.
The trade in the country is new? Yep.
And the brother back.
Yep.
And mentioned being put in prison.
Nothing about prison, their prison, yep, or Simeon being in prison, yep.
They don't mention that in the first place they were all meant to stay there and want to be sent back.
Yep, the first plan, yep. Flick to the next slide, you'll see a couple of other things as well. They bowed down to the man who is the lord of the country. Jacob put his dream, put Jacob's, Joseph's dreams in his mind, he kept the matter in mind. Of the bowing down. I wonder if this might have, that information might have triggered for him that this was fulfillment of that dream. And the other things I think were picked up on there are the finding the silver in the sack on the way home. No mention of that. So why is this? So it's no wonder that Jacob doesn't trust them with Benjamin. It seems that this is all just a bit too good to be true. And even Reuben's ridiculous pledge, have a look in verse 37, "I'll give my own two sons," even that won't change Jacob's mind. Verse 38, he's made up his mind. Jacob answered, "My son will not go down with you, for his brother is dead and he alone is left. If anything happens to him on your journey, you will bring my grey hairs down to Sheol, to the grave in sorrow." He alone is left. Aren't there 10 standing in front of him? Again, it's this favoritism for Benjamin. Well, that's the story. What are we to make of this story? What are we to make of this story? What's God doing through all of this? As you'll see on your outlines, I want to suggest two observations and how they apply to us. First is about providence and personal responsibility. Providence and personal responsibility, and really the relationship between the two of those things. See, Joseph in Egypt is to some extent representing or acting on behalf of God in this account. And like in the previous chapters, God providentially provides for him and Joseph takes responsibility. Both of those things happen. And the two of those things are not separated. Joseph's actions are driven by his fear of God and a special knowledge of what's to come from his dreams. And so his extra knowledge gives him this extra power. The brothers' sheaves, the grain stalks, will bow down to him. The sun and the moon and the 11 stars will bow down to him. They will all bow, parents included. And throughout the narrative, the narrator reminds us that Joseph knows and remembers and recognizes all those words are repeated. And so Joseph then acts in response to that knowledge. He's patiently resisted this temptation to gratify himself in many circumstances so far in the story. And now he's planning to bring his own dream to fulfillment. What about us? Now, we might not have the clarity of a dream like this to know what will happen in our future. But we do know something of what might happen to us. We have our own decisions that we've made and the commitment to those decisions as some level of guidance. We have God's word to us. We have people around us who we trust, whose information we trust. We have the guidance of our gifts and the opportunities God's given to us. And so what are we to do with all of that information? Now, do we just wait for God to do his thing in us? Or do we act on the basis of what we do know? Joseph's an example of action, of planning and doing. You know, even in his 20 years of waiting, he's active. He's actively resisting temptation. He's faithfully stuck at the goal where the destination, when the journey has really looked nothing like getting to that spot. He's taken on the roles he's been given actively and fulfilled them faithfully. And God's used all of those things to bring him to this position of power. And so now as his dream is really close to being realized, he's ready to act. He's ready to act. I wonder if inaction for us can take multiple forms. There's the inaction type of inaction, just doing nothing. But there's also the never really committing to our choices. You know, making a decision that's always draft or trial. I'll check that option out for a little while. No, I'll try something different. I'll go to this church. No, that church. I'll try this job. No, that job. This course. No, that course. See, changing our plans all the time in the hope of finding clarity may actually be because we're avoiding responsibility. And faithful action like Joseph's in these kind of everyday, mundane moments of life, the circumstances he finds himself in, that's what prepares him for faithful action at this point, when he's got a decision before him, decision to take revenge or responsibility for his family. You know, I often think, I'm a bit of an optimist, and I often think that a new circumstance will mean a new me. A new circumstance will mean a new me. I'll find myself in a new circumstance, and I'll be a different person. I'll act differently. My habits will be better when I get there, when I start the new thing. You know, it doesn't happen. Our habits continue. And so maybe the reminder here is actually for us to act now, to be faithful now in the mundane things of life. Act with what we do know. Be faithful, ready for the moment when it might be a bigger decision that's to come. Even when we can't see how that relates to where God is leading us long term. Even when we just feel like it's a winding journey. See, God providentially provides, but that does not remove our responsibility. Through God's providence, Joseph provides for his family physically, but he also provides in another way in this story, and that gets to our second observation. Joseph is initiating reconciliation here. Joseph's initiating reconciliation here. Now, it's a bit tricky right through this story. I wonder if you felt it, to determine what Joseph's motives actually are at any given point. But I think on the whole, we see that his motives are redemptive rather than punitive. You know, he had this opportune moment to take revenge, and he didn't. He tested them, yes, but he didn't take significant revenge. You know, he could have sent them away empty-handed. He could have had them bound to long-term slavery. He could have killed them. But he chose to resist that revenge. How does he do it? I think in part it's through how he interprets his own dreams. His own dreams could to him seem like this great opportunity of self-glorification. All his brothers and family bowing down and worshipping him. Sounds pretty good. That's the goal. He doesn't take it that way. He sees his dreams as an opportunity to provide for his family when this opportunity comes. An opportunity in the end to bring them to Egypt and provide for them. He reneges on his plan to imprison them all in the first place. And he plans instead that they will come back to Egypt, Benjamin included, as we'll see. And all of that opens up the possibility of reconciliation within this divided and dysfunctional family. Resisting revenge is the beginning of reconciliation. Resisting revenge is the beginning of reconciliation. But for this to happen in this story, it takes these tough words, harsh words, tough mercy. Three times Joseph calls them spies. Three times he says, warns them about life and death as a possible consequence of their actions. He's blunt. His truth-telling is what they needed to hear to finally admit their guilt. But it's not just his words, is it? It's this test as well. It's particularly the money test and what that does to them. How that awakens their conscience. See, the money that Joseph ordered to go in their sacks is the mechanism that God uses to bring them to the point of recognizing that it's God who they've ultimately wronged. Notice verse 28. Trembling, they turned to one another and said, "What is this that God has done to us?" See, earlier in verse 22, they just said they were being punished. Now, for the first time, they identify God. He's the cause. And so they recognize that their sin is ultimately against him. Their reconciliation with one another is tied to their reconciliation with God. As they grow to fear God, like Joseph does, they'll be in a place to be reconciled with one another. And to some extent in this account, I think it's already begun, it's only a hint, but in Reuben's ridiculous pledge to go and get Simeon back, I think it's a sign of commitment that he's trying to ease his dad's grief over this whole situation. Joseph's actions have initiated this reconciliation. But it's not just Joseph, is it, who's done that? God is at work right through this story, behind the scenes, through Joseph, through the tests, but also through the great famine. The famine is tough mercy from God. Tough mercy. You know, the promise of a famine in Pharaoh's dreams initially is what leads Joseph to being in this position to be put in charge of the grain, and his brothers then coming to get it from him. It's the test that initiates the other tests that these brothers then face. And it works. It kicks them into action, stops them just looking around at one another and arguing, doing nothing. God is working here to restore this family. See, if all of God's people are truly going to be a blessing to the other nations, it's not just prosperity they need. They actually need unity as well. Together. Sometimes mercy needs to be tough. Sometimes mercy needs to be tough. Sometimes we need to experience the just consequences of our actions in order for us to recognize and seek reconciliation. God often uses the famines of life to bring us back to our senses. That's hard to hear. It's hard to understand when it's happening. But he uses it to bring us back to one another, reconciliation, and ultimately to him. You know, maybe it's a lack in terms of friendships you're feeling even now, deep friendships, a lack in that area, or a guilty conscience that you're feeling that is towards God or isolating you from God or other people. Maybe you're spiritually feeling dry, just not close to God, burnt out, running on empty. If that's you, could it be that that's actually the tough mercy that you need? Think about Jesus' parable in Luke 15. This son, the brother who runs away from the family and lives selfishly with the inheritance in a distant land. And what is it that gets him to come back? It's a famine in the land. He wants to eat from the pig's trough because the famine's that bad. And that leads him to recognize that what he ultimately needs is reconciliation with his family, and he recognizes his sin against God as well. Verse 17 of Luke 15, when he came to his senses, he said, "How many of my father's hired hands have more than enough food, and yet here I am dying of hunger, famine. I'll get up, go to my father and say to him, 'Father, I've sinned against heaven and in your sight, I'm no longer worthy to be called your son.'" See, this admission of unworthiness is what Joseph's brothers needed to come to the place of recognizing their own guilt. God's tough mercy brought them there. Like Joseph, like the father in this story, God doesn't just passively wait for reconciliation to happen. No, he acts. He acts most ultimately in Jesus, through a famine, through a brother in this story, through a son, through Jesus. He steps out, he takes a risk. He bears a cost for us. The cost of concealing his identity for a time, like Joseph. Imagine being Jesus, the Lord of the world, and not letting people recognize who you are. And then ultimately, the cost of the cross. Humiliation. That brings about ultimate reconciliation. That's what we most ultimately need, to be then reconciled with one another. Let me pray that we might understand that more. Our Father, we thank you for this, your word, an interesting story, an intriguing story, and yet one that again points to you and even to your son. And so we pray, Lord, that you might help us to be people who initiate reconciliation, who come before you with our own guilt and shame, but know that you are the one who forgives us and removes that shame. And we thank you for that. And we pray in Jesus' name. Amen.